This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Another pedestrian fatality in Veterans Parkway raises safety concerns, Ryan Denham reports. Plus, the town of Normal is getting ready to revamp its bicycle and pedestrian plan, and the public has shown a lot of interest in trail crossings.
How those crossings cross our arterials, some of our minor collectors, and so we want to take a hard look at those and make that crossing safer.
Town engineer Ryan Otto and planner Mercy Davison wheel their way through a bike plan interview with Mary Cullen. A public radio investigation into Commonwealth Edison shows the utility paid a lobbyist more than $3 million, a lobbyist connected to Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan. A big honking federal grant comes to the town of Normal for an uptown underpass. Laura Kennedy previews a production of the Pulitzer Prize winning play Sweat, and a half century of McLean County disaster planning gets recognition. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The town of Normal found out this week it is getting $13 million from the federal government to build its long-planned uptown underpass. That does not mean the project is a done deal. WGLT's Ryan Denham reports on what is next.
Local, state, and federal officials gathered yesterday at Uptown Station to celebrate the town winning the $13 million grant. Congressman Rodney Davis praised Normal leaders for lobbying so hard for the money, including on multiple one-voice trips to D.C.
This project is going to get $13 million of your taxpayer dollars back. That's a big deal.
Now the town needs to figure out how to pay for the rest of the project. The town submitted its build grant application to the U.S. Department of Transportation in July. Then it asked for $16 million and said it would kick in $7 million in town money. The total project cost was going to be $24 million. But now DOT has granted $13 million. It's $3 million less than they requested. Town officials say they'll rework the project, value engineering as they call it, maybe try to bring the total cost down. They'll also seek other funding sources, possibly more money from the state. The original grant application called for a 65-35% split between the federal government and state and local funding. Here's Normal Mayor Chris Coos.
But we can't change it too much because, you know, some of the elements that we promised in our grant, we can't change the scope of the project.
Coos has stressed that the amount of local funding is still very much undecided, but that the goal is to use as little in town funds as possible.
We've got some work to do before we can really lay out a really tight package about what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, and what the timeline would be.
Yesterday at the press conference at Uptown Station, State Representative Dan Brady said there might be additional state funding available beyond the $1 million or so that the state has already committed. He says the Capitol bill is one possibility.
There are other avenues out there, and we are going to obviously be pursuing those other avenues.
Congressman Davis helped secure the funds from DOT, working with Congressman Darren LaHood and Illinois Senators Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth. Davis says town officials are going to figure out how to fund the rest of the project.
It's a good problem to have right now. There are a lot of communities that submitted applications that I represent. And, you know, the excitement that we feel here today is now disappointment in their areas because they weren't awarded. They would have been glad to take a part of what they applied for.
WGLT obtained a copy of the original grant application the town submitted to DOT in July. It sold the project as a pedestrian and cyclist safety measure. Around 1,800 pedestrians and cyclists cross the tracks every day. There'd also be safety benefits for the Children's Discovery Museum, one of the earliest anchors in the redeveloped uptown. It noted the museum currently has extremely limited outdoor space, and the only access to the larger space in Uptown South for outdoor activities requires staff to walk kids across the tracks at Linden Street. The application also sold the economic impact of the project. In the short term, the project is expected to create 400 jobs during construction. Local union leader John Penn says that's huge for workers' incomes and benefits.
But jobs are jobs, and that means a good living for our people.
Long term, the underpass will tie together the more developed north side of Uptown with its less developed south side, also known as Uptown 2.0. Portions of Uptown South have been reserved for a new public library and a public park. Coos also says affordable housing will be a priority there. But until now, Coos says the physical and psychological barrier of the railroad tracks may have deterred developers.
And future development in the area south of the tracks will transform existing public property into productive uses that meets community needs.
In their grant application, town officials said they hope to complete the final design of the underpass in 2020, with construction taking place in 2021 and finishing in late 2022. It's unclear how exactly that timeline or the project's full scope will change, given the smaller-than-requested $13 million award. Congressman Rodney Davis says he's proud to be part of the project.
And I cannot wait for the groundbreaking, and more importantly, I can't wait for the ribbon cutting, because that's going to be a great day.
This will be at least the second large federal grant in support of Uptown redevelopment. Normal received a $22 million Tiger grant toward construction of Uptown Station in the new City Hall. That opened in 2012. Tiger grants were the predecessor of Build grants. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can read the winning grant application that the town submitted to the federal government at our website, WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from Illinois State's College of Business, one of the top best undergraduate business schools in the nation, as ranked by Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. Program and degree details at business.illinoisstate.edu. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come on the show, a public radio investigation into Commonwealth Edison lobbying reveals some connected dots between the utility and people close to House Speaker Michael Madigan. Veterans Parkway is one of Bloomington Normal's widest and busiest roads, up to 9 lanes in some sections. It can be hard to negotiate for drivers and even more treacherous for pedestrians. WGLT's Ryan Denham reports on renewed concerns about pedestrian safety on Veterans in the wake of 2 fatal incidents in the last 6 weeks.
The most recent incident happened Wednesday night around 8:30. Authorities say 25-year-old Vincent V. Shorten of Normal was struck by at least one vehicle as he walked east across Veterans, just north of Fort Jesse Road. Yesterday, Normal police said they found a second vehicle that may have also hit him. Shorten's death comes just 6 weeks after 18-year-old Reginald Hubbard was struck and killed while walking near Veterans and Empire in Bloomington.
It's extremely difficult for pedestrians and people on bicycles, anyone who's not in a motor vehicle.
That's Jennifer Six, transportation planner at the McLean County Regional Planning Commission. She says Veterans was not designed, nor did it grow with pedestrians in mind. There is an underpass at Veterans and Vernon Avenue or GE Road, plus a few crosswalks at various intersections. There are also several pedestrian stopping points within the median up and down Veterans.
I don't think those get used very much, and it's because nobody feels confident or safe standing there.
Normal Town Council member Kevin McCarthy says he's aware of the public perception that Veterans is not pedestrian friendly.
I would love to tell everybody to use the Constitution Trail, you know, that goes under Towanda and under Veterans Parkway, right? And then we would just avoid, but you know, the reality is somebody that needs to get up by Fort Jesse isn't going to go all the way down there.
One complicating factor is that Veterans is a state route, putting it under Illinois Department of Transportation jurisdiction. Jennifer Six says she's encouraged by IDOT's upcoming $600,000 feasibility study that'll look at reworking Veterans and Empire. She says traffic engineering philosophies have changed in recent years at all levels, including IDOT, to better emphasize pedestrians and cyclists. Six says other communities use all sorts of creative measures, like watch for pedestrian signs, reflective crosswalks, lights, whatever it takes.
You know, if they want to shoot off fireworks periodically, I don't know that anyone's tried that, but anything to sort of bring the driver's attention to the fact that there are other users of the roadway who can't get out of their way and that they need to be conscious of that.
IDOT spokesperson Guy Tridgell says safety is their top priority. They always look to work with local communities to ensure that any improvements address their needs and concerns. Normal's director of engineering, Ryan Otto, says that once the details about Wednesday night's incident become clear, the town of Normal will share them with IDOT.
We will review all the details, the signals, the accommodations that are available, if they were used, if they were not used, and we just want to make sure we understand everything about it and work with the state to make sure that if we can do something different there, that we will.
The incident remains under investigation. I'm Ryan Denham.
The emphasis on safety is timely, not only because of the fatality, but normal officials say they want to make the town even safer for pedestrians and bicyclists 10 years after the first bicycle and pedestrian master plan in town. Town planner Mercy Davison and town engineer Ryan Otto tell WGLT's Mary Cullen priorities have changed.
The town originally created a bicycle and pedestrian master plan in 2009. So, you know, 10 years later, it seems like a great time to revisit it. A lot has changed in the world of design. Certainly in 10 years, the community's priorities might have shifted. It's just a really good time to re-examine what we've already put down on paper.
In 2009, what were some of the priorities then, and how have those changed to now?
Well, neither Ryan nor I were here in 2009 on this plan. Now, Ryan was actually not at the town of Normal. I was here but didn't work on it. But we've been working on the priorities as a team since then. And at the beginning of our existing plan, there's a list of some high priorities, and they include things like making certain improvements to east-west connectivity in Normal for pedestrians and bicyclists, how to get from the east to the west. We don't really have a solid trail connection for that. There was discussion of how to cross Veterans Parkway, discussions of just, you know, the higher priority areas of the community, how could they be improved?
There's a lot of new standards out there, and so we want to take those to the community and see, you know, if priorities of the community have changed. Is the different aspects of the plan need more emphasis? Is there more emphasis on pedestrian travel? There's a lot of new standards out there for ADA standards. The U.S. Access Board has come out with PROAG, which is the proposed right-of-way accessibility guidelines. And so those new standards can maybe change opinions on how we spend our dollars. So we want to definitely want to get a lot of public input on this and see where folks are having difficulty with connectivity and getting around town.
Now, the public input that you've received since 2009, I mean, what are people mostly talking about? What do they want to see changed or need to see changed?
You know, 10 years is a long time to get comments. And I mean, for the most part, we aren't receiving some avalanche of comments about bicycle and pedestrian design aspects of the community. Certainly, we've had a lot of positive response to some of the changes we've made. We've put in some really important sidewalk connections over the past few years that then we hear positive feedback on that. We've extended the trail a couple of times in very significant ways, which obviously that generates a lot of happiness and a lot of good comments and feedback. But it kind of comes and goes with projects and as opportunities present themselves.
Yeah, one comment we hear quite often is trail crossings and how those crossings cross our arterials, some of our minor collectors, and so we want to take a hard look at those and make sure that we're doing what we can to make that crossing safer.
And how does this project fit in with the money that was received for around the train station area? How does this fit in with that?
The underpass project is an urban connector that will tie in. It's an integral part of Constitution Trail, the main branch coming through uptown. And so it's a big part of that. It will help connect south of the tracks. The Union Pacific Railroad is a big barrier through our uptown area and really through the whole community. So it'll be just one less conflict when pedestrians and bikes cross.
Back to the public input session, which is, what's the date on that?
We have an open house coming up next Wednesday, November 13th, at the Community Activity Center, which is over in One Normal Plaza. It'll be from 5 to 7 p.m. It's mostly an open house format, so we'll have poster boards and informational materials out, maps, things that people can look at. So it'll be pretty informal, a lot of opportunity to talk to staff and the consultant. We will do a couple of brief presentations, one at 5:15, one at 6:15, so that anyone who wants to just, you know, sit down for 5-10 minutes and hear about the overall process, you know, we'd be happy to talk to them about that. So it's a really nice, friendly way to have some comments. It's not like coming into a room and sitting under the spotlight and testifying. It's really an informal, very informational event.
And obviously, that's just one step on this timeline. Is there an end to this project?
We hope to wrap up the plan sometime in the late summer. Then we will take the input we got, you know, how we came about with the final plan, and take those and start looking at our capital investment plan and start incorporating some of those projects into that plan as we move forward into new fiscal years. Many of our projects, unfortunately, take many years to implement. 10 years, there's been a lot done, but it's still 10 years. It's a long time. So a lot of these projects are 2, 3, 4 years in planning. So we want to make sure we get things started and keep things rolling with make sure we can enhance safety and connectivity and accessibility for citizens. And really, we're looking for input as part of the process. The purpose of the open house is to bring people together, hear what folks are saying out there, where they're having difficulties, what they like. We need to have all that kind of input so we make sure that we're incorporating things that we're not aware of. We're aware of a lot of different things, but we want the public to weigh in on what they like and what they don't like with our sidewalks, with our bike lanes, with our roads.
This is still early in the stages, but budgeting-wise, how is this program going to be funded?
We will certainly pursue funding from the state. We've gotten grants in the past, specifically for Constitution Trail extensions. That's one of the funding opportunities that we do have available to us for enhancement-type projects. We call it transportation enhancement projects in the lingo of the State Department of Transportation. So we'll be pursuing other funding types as well as utilizing town funds. We have funds available each year to us for upgrades to sidewalks, handicap ramps, things that we try to do each year to maintain our infrastructure.
And there's just been a growing body of evidence over the last 10 years about how transportation systems affect human health, and communities that provide better opportunities for people to get around outside of a vehicle. So, you know, whether someone can walk, get on a skateboard, rollerblade, ride their bicycle, the more people have that opportunity, the healthier your community is, for pretty obvious reasons. So for that reason, there are actually a lot more grants available now nationally for tying transportation to health and wellness. So we would certainly also be looking at those sorts of grants.
WGLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Normal Town Planner Mercy Davison and Town Engineer Ryan Otto. The town will hold an open house on the bike and pedestrian master plan process on November 13th.
Partnering with WGLT works for CertaPro Painters.
I appreciate everything that WGLT does in the community, and I want to help support that. GLT was just, you know, that was a no-brainer for us.
Mark Mulick with CertaPro, a new WGLT underwriter.
So we're going after the decision makers, the people that want to be up to date with current events and all that kind of stuff.
Partnering with WGLT works for CertaPro Painters. Find out how it can work for you at WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from Community Players Theater, presenting 8-time Tony Award-winning show Cabaret for 3 weekends in November. Set in a Berlin nightclub in 1931, romance blossoms even as Nazism threatens the city. Tickets at communityplayers.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, more planning, a different kind of planning, disaster planning, and the long history of it in Bloomington Normal, a piece on that. Chicago Public Radio has learned a former Commonwealth Edison lobbyist got millions of dollars from the utility during the years before his offices were raided by the FBI. ComEd is now under federal criminal investigation for its lobbying activities, and a new investigation has found dozens of politically connected companies and individuals on ComEd's payroll while it pursued a big legislative agenda in Springfield. WBEZ's state political reporter Dave McKinney talks with Melba Lara about what he found. Melba begins by asking Dave to recap why the FBI is investigating the electric company and how it relates to state government.
Since before May, federal investigators have been interested in ComEd. They're looking into whether the company hired multiple politically connected contractors and employees in exchange for favorable government treatment. The company's been wanting lawmakers to approve a bailout of its financially ailing nuclear power plants, and that could mean a rate hike for consumers. Now, some of House Speaker Michael Madigan's allies and a Democratic state senator had their offices and homes raided by the FBI as part of this probe.
So, Dave, you've reported before that ComEd is under scrutiny for its contracting, but it's been pretty hard to come by details of who is actually getting those contracts. But you and your colleagues, Tony Arnold and Dan Mihalopoulos, spent some time looking at public records. What did you find in those records?
Well, Melba, we wound up finding 10 years' worth of data that ComEd filed with federal utility regulators that took a bit of digging to uncover. Those records showed us many of the contractors ComEd has used over the years for things like business consulting, legal work, and even power washing for its fleet of trucks. We found dozens of companies and individuals who have been on ComEd's payroll, and they're closely connected to political A-listers, such as House Speaker Madigan and indicted Chicago Alderman Ed Burke. Even a former Illinois First Lady got a contract.
And, Dave, I want to ask you about a guy named Jay Doherty. You and the politics team have reported before on him. He's the president of a civic group that's called the City Club of Chicago. Also, he's a key figure in this investigation. Tell us what you found out about him.
Well, not only is he president of the public affairs group you mentioned, Melba, he moonlights as a lobbyist for ComEd, and his offices at City Club were raided by the FBI back in May. We've previously reported that the feds were looking for records on up to 20 people, including Madigan. Now, ComEd's filings with the federal government show Doherty got more than $3.1 million. That's vastly more than what he had disclosed in city lobbying records. You know, it's important to say that Doherty has not been charged, and while we've known that he's involved in the investigation, we never knew that ComEd had been paying him millions of dollars.
And aside from Doherty, you found that ComEd hired several other politically connected people and companies, including some with connections to this ongoing criminal probe. Tell us what else is there.
You know, we found a power washing company that ComEd pays hundreds of thousands of dollars to. It's owned by a former campaign worker to State Senator Martin Sandoval. Now, his offices were raided in late September, and we've previously reported that Sandoval's daughter works at ComEd. We also learned that ComEd employs the daughter-in-law of former state representative Luis Arroyo. Now, if you remember him, he was charged with bribery connected to his own lobbying side job, and he resigned last week. Another firm we found received more than $22 million from ComEd for facilities management. It's co-owned by Tom Donovan, former patronage chief to Mayor Richard J. Daley and a friend of Doherty's. Donovan's firm gave tens of thousands of dollars to the speaker and to Alderman Burke.
That is political reporter Dave McKinney of Chicago Public Radio talking with Mel Ballara about the FBI investigation into Commonwealth Edison and links to people close to House Speaker Mike Madigan. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Charlie Schlenker, and you're listening to Sound Ideas. When disaster strikes, we take it for granted that first responders, public health, schools, and other community agencies will all work together for the common good. That does not happen on its own. And for the last 50 years, the McLean County Disaster Council has been the driving force behind that collaboration. WGLT's Ryan Dunham talks to the McLean County Disaster Council President David Hopper about how the business of preparedness has changed since 1969.
We had a civil defense director by the name of Al Thomas, and he recognized that we had many different emergency response agencies in the county, but each one had their own plans. They had very effective plans, but there's very little collaboration among them. So if a disaster were to strike that they were each involved in, they would individually know what to do, but they wouldn't know how to work together. And so Mr. Thomas is actually he was the driving force behind creating the Disaster Council, which brought them all together so that they could share ideas, they could network with each other, they could integrate their plans so that they could better make use of what McLean County emergency response resources we had. So it really goes back to Mr. Thomas.
Today in 2019, who is part of the McLean County Disaster Council? What's sort of the range of membership?
Well, and it's interesting because in those early years, it was restricted for the most part to fire, law enforcement, and government agencies. Over the years, and a lot has happened, of course, in this country since 1969, so there's much more of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. They adhere to a principle called whole community preparedness, which that is you involve as many stakeholders as possible into the planning process, because it's not that disasters are more complicated than they were. There's just more of a recognition that they're more complex. They involve, if a disaster strikes McLean County, it's not going to be something that you, that the fire service, the police departments, the EMS can just address. You know, they address it and it's all done. It's going to affect our faith-based community. It's going to affect social service agencies, public health, our private businesses. So over the years since 1969, the Disaster Council actually has grown with that in mind. So today we have your traditional first responders. We have fire departments, fire agencies, police departments, EMS. We have hospitals. We have private business, government agencies, including the Public Health Department, Emergency Management Agency. We have faith-based organizations. So we have a much wider array of different organizations that come to the table so that we can really better represent what our population looks like.
While our listeners may be familiar with the different pieces that comprise the McLean County Disaster Council, the council itself is probably best known to the public for the annual exercise that, that you guys do each year to test emergency preparedness in this community. What are some examples of ones that you've done in recent years that they may stand out to people's memories?
The ones that people would probably most connect with would be the big, they're called full-scale exercises, and those are a lot of different disciplines come together. We actually are physically responding in the way that we would during a real event, during one of these scenarios, of course. And so this most recent summer, the airport runs an exercise every 3 years where they have to simulate a plane crash that results in victims. So it's a mass casualty triage event where we had fire, police, EMS, hospitals, the FBI was there, at the airport, of course, airport response. We're all physically addressing the scenario. They were all physically interacting with our victims for the exercise. Last year, we did a mass dispensing exercise at Redbird Arena, where it was if there was a public health emergency where we had to get medicine to the community as quickly as possible, it was exercising that process. And so that brought a lot of the same people to the table.
So let's pretend Al Thomas 50 years ago was not so gung-ho about this idea. So let's pretend that the McLean County Disaster Council never formed in the way it's currently constituted, this thing that's holding the agencies together in times of need. How do you think this community's level of preparedness would be different today if such a council never existed?
It would be a stark contrast with what it is today. I mean, McLean County is very fortunate. The disaster council we have is unique, if not a standalone in the state. There's actually been recognition of it statewide. I've worked in another county prior to this one, and I had never heard of anything like the disaster council. And so I know without a doubt that McLean County is better prepared for this disaster council existing than it wouldn't. There are other settings in which we do collaborate with other agencies, but not really an opportunity like the Disaster Council presents. I mean, it is all the different disciplines, all the different organizations at the table. We all share from each of our perspectives what we're worried about, you know, what could happen in the county. And then when we have these big drills and exercises, it's that actual putting into effect what our individual plans are and how we're going to communicate and work with one another. So McLean County is much better off for the Disaster Council being here.
I want to talk a little bit about disaster preparedness generally and how it's sort of changed over time. Technology especially changes any business over time, right? So I'm in the news business, so you know, we used to lay out newspaper pages by hand, and then we got computers, and now everything is read on the screen. So what are those ways that technology has changed the disaster preparedness industry business since in your career, at least?
Communication is definitely one of the big ones. If we don't rely just on radio communication, even though the radio communication itself has improved immensely over the years, but we have, I know one system, and it mirrors a lot of other systems out there. It's called Web EOC. It's basically Web Emergency Operations Center. So it is a platform by which we can share information from discipline to discipline. And so we don't, whereas in the past, an Emergency Operations Center, it was a physical location where all these different representatives representatives and agencies can meet, and they can really address whatever the disaster is. They can share information. WebEOC allows us to do that virtually. So you don't have to physically be sitting in the same room with somebody to let them know from the health department's perspective, there was this public health emergency. We're expecting the medication from the federal government. We're going to be opening up our point of dispensing at 8 o'clock tonight. We don't have to be in the same room with somebody to share that with the emergency management agency, with the hospitals, with law enforcement, fire. We can use a system like WebEOC and just kind of post it to that. Everybody can see it.
So earlier you mentioned FEMA's whole community preparedness,
yes,
sort of model, this view of preparedness being not just for the fire department to worry about.
Right.
What are some of the other sort of larger philosophical evolutions within preparedness that have taken place in the last 10, 20, 30 years, especially pre and post 9/11? I imagine that was sort of a pivot point.
No, it absolutely was. At the health department, we focused on public health preparedness, but when we do that, we really give the picture of pre 9/11. It was a ton of focus on the traditional first responders. I mean, that's what people associated with emergency management was fire, police, EMS. Post 9/11, it's just a different world. I mean, there are so many, like, disasters can affect our communities in so many different ways, or at least they affect them the same way, but there's, as I said, there's more of a recognition on what the consequence is when a disaster strikes. And so it's because when we think about emergency management, there's the preparation phase, which is what we're in now. It is a beautiful Thursday afternoon in Bloomington. There's not a huge disaster occurring. So this is kind of the goal, because when the disaster strikes, that's response. Response is I'm addressing whatever happened, tornado, public health emergency. Recovery is trying to get back to the normal, trying to get back to this beautiful day in Bloomington. And so it's really changed post 9/11 because there's more of that attention on how is a disaster really impacting all segments of society so that we can address all of that, so we can really shorten that recovery time, so that we can address if there are a bunch of displaced people, we can address that. If there were people who were suffering with a functional need prior to the disaster, whether it's they lacked transportation or they were non-English speaking or whatever the case may be, that disaster would have disproportionately affected them. We can identify, since we have so many more people at the table, we can identify all of those at-risk groups out there so that we can hopefully have something in place to assist each of them so that we can all get back to that normal again, that preparation time again, that much quicker.
The thing about disasters, though, is that the real ones don't come around all that often,
yes,
right? So in McLean County's history, I mean, how many true quote-unquote disasters of any measurable scale have we had and had to respond to?
Well, in 2009, during the H1N1 response, that was a pandemic influenza event. So it required coordinating these efforts with all these different partners I mentioned. So we had to, we received vaccine from the federal government to give to people, to vaccinate people, to hopefully keep them from getting that H1N1 virus. And in doing so, we set up numerous clinics all across McLean County. Some of them were very sizable clinics where we would have hundreds of people, getting vaccinated. And that took a ton of coordination between, obviously, the health department, but emergency management was there, law enforcement was there. And having a disaster council there, like as I said earlier, just the opportunities to meet ahead of time so that when the disaster strikes, when we really need all these resources, we're not picking up the phone book at that time and trying to, like, thumb through a phone book, trying to find who is their emergency manager director, who's the police chief in Bloomington. We know all those people ahead of time. So if another event such as H1N1 were to strike again, just like in 2009, we'd already know who all those people are. And so it would really speed up that whole response to the event.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with David Hopper, Emergency Preparedness Coordinator for the McLean County Health Department and also the president of the McLean County Disaster Council. So, David, you have your the 50th anniversary coming up for
yes.
the Disaster Council with a celebration planned for Thursday, November 14th at the former airport building on Empire. It's from 4 to 6 p.m. So what's going to be happening at this this event?
Well, it's really an opportunity to showcase the Disaster Council. We will have emergency vehicles staged right outside of that old terminal so that people, you know, the community is 100% more than welcomed. We want them to be there. And so just people can kind of check out what emergency resources there are out there, kind of just check out the fire engines and the squad cars and all the different things we would use to respond to events. But then we will have a slideshow with some of the pictures from some of our old exercises. So if you haven't seen somebody all moulaged up and all the disaster makeup, you can see what it looked like at the airport exercise in 2019 and 2016. You can see pictures from our 2018 mass dispensing exercise and that improvised explosive device exercise I mentioned earlier. So you can see kind of what it looks like when we're implementing all of these plans. And of course, obviously, these are exercises, but they mirror what we would do during real events. And then you can meet the Disaster Council members. You know, you can, for those of you who are maybe heard of the Disaster Council, but aren't really certain what our role is, kind of what we do, why we meet once every couple months. You can talk to us. You can ask us questions. You can just get to know about this really great resource that has existed for 50 years and is here to make sure that McLean County is safer than it would be otherwise.
That's David Hopper, Emergency Preparedness Coordinator for the McLean County Health Department. He's also the president of the McLean County Disaster Council, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. I'm Ryan Denham.
The Disaster Council's 50th anniversary open house will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday, November 14th at the former Central Illinois Regional Airport Terminal Building on Empire Street in Bloomington. Coming up on Bloomington Normal's Public Media and Sound Ideas, Laura Kennedy has a preview of a Pulitzer Prize-winning play that is entering into local production. A pilot program in the Chicago area aims to break the cycle of homelessness through better health. The pilot program stresses the importance of collaboration and cost sharing. WGLT's Eric Stock reports McLean County is working on a similar model.
The program is called Better Health Through Housing. Organizers in Cook County say they've taken nearly 50 people off the streets and into shelter in the first 6 months. Nonprofits secured promises from hospitals and health insurers to pay for housing for the homeless that the hospitals identify as frequent users of the healthcare system. Carlos De Jesus Rivera is director of housing for the Center for Housing and Health, the lead agency for the program.
If you take housing into account, the health conditions of the participants will significantly improve, and therefore it's a savings on health dollars when that happens. So housing is tantamount to health care.
De Jesus Rivera says many without a roof over their head get caught in a vicious health cycle.
Just being exposed to the elements in Chicago, it makes any condition you have worse. And so if you're housed, then you can have insulin in your refrigerator. You can be in a sheltered environment.
Others say the program also addresses racial inequality. Julie Nelson of the Corporation for Supportive Housing says 80% of the homeless population in Chicago is African American.
People of color are targeted for arrests. Convictions look different. That then impacts ability to get work. That impacts evictions. And so that drives people towards homelessness.
The program creates a flexible housing pool. Caseworkers help homeless clients with insurance and housing and try to make sure they get to the doctor. Patricia Strokes is with Housing Forward, an agency contracted to provide caseworkers. She says the program goes beyond the sustainable housing the federal government offers because healthcare staff see firsthand who needs housing assistance.
They know that a person is physically vulnerable because the hospital, the medical systems are working with them, but they don't necessarily have to be homeless in the same way.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development offers supportive housing funding only for those it defines as chronically homeless and disabled. The original model for the Cook County service is in Los Angeles. That effort reports sharp drops in emergency room visits, days in the hospital, and fewer mental health hospitalizations over the first 7 years of the program. Julie Nelson with the Corporation for Supportive Housing says the flexible housing pool is adaptable anywhere you have health care and community partners willing to work together.
So a lot of it can be driven by data within the own community. So understanding who your frequent utilizers are, creating partnerships, building those relationships across these partners between the private sector, between hospitals, between government, between your homeless service providers, and really going from there to identify a common goal.
CSH has also been working with the McLean County in its efforts to stem homelessness by identifying those who most frequently need health care or homeless services or go to jail. That's through the county's new FUSE program. It stands for Frequent User Systems Engagement. McLean County Mental Health Program Supervisor Tricia Malott says FUSE's goal is to provide mental health and substance abuse services and help the homeless find stable housing and employment. Malott says the program is located only to frequent users in the first 2 months. The startup plan is for service to 10 clients per year. She says once the program has reportable results, the county will ask hospitals and health insurers to help defray costs.
That's our goal. So we continue to have dialogue with both hospitals to try to be able to incorporate that so that we truly can get to the folks who are intersecting all high need, high cost systems.
The county has set aside about $670,000 for FUSE annually through a sales tax increase in Bloomington and Normal approved a few years ago. I'm Eric Stock.
Several foundations offer housing for the homeless in Peoria through a variety of funding sources, including local lenders and tax credits for low-income housing and for historic properties. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org and Sound Ideas. Hello, I'm Charlie Schlenker. A shifting economic landscape leads to layoffs and desperation in the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Sweat, opening this weekend at Illinois State University. WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy speaks with the director about the timeliness of this production.
The demise of a factory and a friendship make Sweat by Lynn Nottage a play that cuts close to an inescapable reality of community without opportunity. Opening November 8th at Illinois State University's Westhoff Theater, Sweat is directed by the head of the acting program at ISU, Lori Adams. She admits she was drawn to this play because playwright Lynn Nottage is a strong and authentic voice in 21st century American theater.
Much of the same way that Arthur Miller understands and loves Willie Loman and Clifford Odets understood the taxi driver striking in his play, Lynn Nottage understands these people. And those people are my heartbeat, and so now she is my heartbeat again. I love her voice, and I feel akin to it, and I love the people that she thinks are important enough to put in her plays. It is so timely that, I mean, I don't know if you know this, but she moved to Reading, Pennsylvania for 2.5 years. She literally practically lived there because she wanted to get the real, you know, the real guts of this story of the entire idea of NAFTA and industry moving out of this country just kind of like overnight, and the whole breaking up unions and, you know, everything that's in this play.
Is it fair to call it a Rust Belt drama?
Yes, I think it is definitely a Rust Belt drama. The plot centers around two women, Cynthia, who is black, and Tracy, who is white, and their sons, Jason and Chris, and they are all residents of Reading, Pennsylvania. They all work at the steel mill. They're union members. Overnight, what happens is the doors get locked, and they're locked out. And then, of course, they strike, but by the time it all ends up, the company has moved all the jobs to Mexico. The action of the play takes place in a bar, which is where they hang out after work and where they commiserate after things happen to them. The conceit of the show is that it jumps back and forth. It opens in 2008, then immediately goes back to the central part of the show in 2000 when all this happens. And then at the end comes back to 2008. I don't want to give away any plots, but something really devastating happens as a result of all this. And we find out something happened. We don't know what it is until we make our way all the way through the play and then we come back.
So you basically get to watch as events unfold and people are at the mercy of events and how they react to it that leads to this tragedy.
Absolutely. It's fascinating to see the decisions that are made. The friendships that they forged and were solid before this happened then are blown apart, and that included racism and classism and sexism and everything else.
So why, Laura, did you decide to direct Sweat? What was it about this play? You're clearly charged up about it, mm-hmm. but you have to make a choice each school year. Well, what am I going to direct? This seems to be mega timely.
Yeah, I did say to the production committee, I said, you know, I've been doing this many, many years, and so if you'll let me, I'd really like to do something that is really close to my heart. And I really, at this point in my life, want to do something that matters. And I think all theater matters, yes. but in a way that this one matters.
Why is it close to your heart?
Well, I grew up in Nebraska, working class. My parents were working class. All my family was working class. I was the first person to go to college. So there's a big part of the world's view of these people that I understand on some level, even though all of my adult life I've been in, you know, the theater or in the university setting. I sort of get them.
Are you finding a way to weave in your past into this current production?
If nothing else, my deep respect for their work ethic and their loyalty, and my sorrow at the injustice of how we do not take care enough of the people that sometimes need it the most. And so there's all kinds of themes weaved through it that make us think of what's going on today. I mean, these people not only lose their salary, they lose their health care. They lose their pension. I mean, these are topics that people of great means would not understand.
Yeah, drug addiction is addressed in the play, and certainly folks who work in factory situations, you know, you're putting your whole body into your work, you get injured, and drug addiction is right out the door waiting to take a hold. How does the playwright address this in the show?
Yes, it's one of the themes that pops up in the show. I mean, one person gets injured, and like you say, and as a result of that becomes addicted to painkillers. And another person in the play develops a severe drug addiction because of losing his job.
He lost himself.
He lost his identity. He worked at a place for 35 years, and all of a sudden it's gone.
There's also a character named Oscar. Can you tell us a bit about Oscar and how he impacts the other characters? Because Oscar wanted to get in at the factory.
Right. Oscar is a Colombian. He is a barback at the bar. But you're right. He wants to get in. He wants to be in the factory. He wants to make that kind of money. The curious thing about Oscar in the play is that he rarely speaks. He's around all the time because he's cleaning up and scraping gum off the bottom of chairs and sweeping and doing all the things that you do when you're at the bar back in a bar. So he is kind of the character that, if in doubt, we would look and see what he's thinking as he's kind of overhearing everything that's going on. So in a way, I always think he's kind of like the Greek chorus in a Greek tragedy. You know, we go, what's going on? But he's pivotal to the story and what happens in the story. He becomes that way. But the racism that is shown toward Hispanic people is very prominent in the play.
I think one of the more striking things about the play is the fact that really at the heart of it you have a female friendship. Female friendship doesn't get explored enough, it seems.
Right. Oh, I'm so glad you said that. Exactly. Female friendship. Women that had marriages together, then those marriages are not existing anymore. They raised children together. They have been friends. They worked. More importantly, they worked together all these years. They are best friends. Yeah, then there's a promotion that happens in the job where they then get in conflict with each other. But you're right, it's a life-affirming relationship to watch.
How are your students reacting to the script in rehearsals? They're being exposed to some of this stuff for the very first time, some of them, I would imagine.
You know, our ISU students in the acting area are just wonderful students, and And we often talk about them and say, you know, they're kind of scrappy and they kind of want it a lot and messy. And those are all the qualities we need for this show. There's no neatness about it. It's kind of messy. I have some very young students. There's several sophomores in the cast, but also some upperclassmen. They are working. I mean, they're being asked to do not only to play people that are older than them, some of them, but just the drug addiction, the weight of the world on their shoulders, the tiredness that a person that's over 40 feels rather than when you're 20. And they're just, you know, they're...
It's hard to imagine the disillusion when you haven't really reached that yet.
Exactly. And that the very thing we love about youth is they're not disillusioned. And then for them to, yeah, just, you know, at any given time saying, now this, I mean, I'm pretty healthy here, but this is how I get up off the floor. As compared to you. Or when I sit there quietly thinking, it's because I have these other things I have to think about. You're right. It's very interesting process, but they're really coming up to bat.
Lori, what are you trying to achieve with this production?
When you feel like a forgotten person, and I don't think there's a female alive that has not sometime in their life felt like a forgotten person. This play is about people who felt like they were forgotten, and in some ways were forgotten or are forgotten. I guess I want to bring them into the light so we don't forget them.
That's Lori Adams, director of Sweat by Lynn Nottage, running the 8th through the 16th at Illinois State University's West Off Theater. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Sweat is the second play for which writer Lynn Nottage won the Pulitzer Prize. She also scooped up the honor in 2009 for the play Ruined. That made her the first woman to have won the prize twice. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Ryan Denham, Mary Cullen, Eric Stock, and Laura Kennedy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We'd like to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page. We're WGLT-FM. Or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.